we're discussing how 911 calls are delivered and handled and the work of 911 operators. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This conversation was suggested by Bob from Richland Center. So thank you, Bob. Dozens of 911 call centers in our state are in the midst of upgrading their systems to what's known as Next Gen 911. It's a digital platform that offers new GPS capabilities for coordination. Have you ever had to dial 911? What do you remember about the call you had with the operator? What questions do you have about how the system works? It's 800-642-1234. Paul Logan is Training and Standards Manager for Dane County 911. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks, Kate.
Good morning. Well, take us on a tour first, if you will, into a call center, what it looks like, what your setup is.
Well, it's in our particular case, we have 21 workstations in our call center. Each workstation has a minimum of six computer monitors, numerous keyboards, numerous mice, and it allows our communicators, that's the job title for our frontline folks, and allows them to have access to numerous different systems at each workstation.
How has it been in the pandemic with your communicators? How have you managed?
Well, it's been a challenging, stressful year for the communicators. Most county employees here in Dane County, of course, are working remote. And while we can touch on that, we do actually have some folks working remote, but they've pretty much been here throughout the pandemic, throughout the civil unrest that was taking place in Madison. We've been wearing masks here in the communication center since last March or April, so almost a year now, or more than a year. And it's been stressful. It's been very stressful. We've actually had some attrition this year that we haven't seen in the last few years.
Yeah, and you mentioned attrition. That is a problem that plagues, 911 centers straight across the country. Attrition, low pay, high stress. What are you seeing?
Attrition typically across the country runs close to 20% annually.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of turnover. We're blessed in Dane County that our county board and our elected officials value our service. I think we're paid very well. We're probably, with our pay and benefits package, we're probably some of the highest paid dispatchers, telecommunicators in the state, and even beyond. We're blessed.
One statistic I came across from Nina, your professional organization, says it takes 6 months to train a 911 dispatch professional at a cost of up to $200,000. Is that the reality, to train someone up?
That is the reality, and in some cases maybe a low estimate.
Wow.
We have a very complicated system. Dane County is 1,000 square miles. And we provide service to the vast majority of police, fire, and EMS in that county. And so geography and knowing the different agencies and then learning all of our technical systems, it's very challenging, and it does take a long time. And it's a job that not everybody can do. It takes a very special person. And so we work very hard to train our folks and keep them trained and keep them up to date. But yes, it's very challenging and it takes a while.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Paul Logan of Dane County 911. He's the Training and Standards Manager. You can join in. Have you ever had to dial 911 due to an emergency? What do you remember about the conversation you had with the communicator? Did you remain calm? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, let's look further at how the system works. When someone dials 911, how does the system know which call center in Wisconsin to connect to?
Well, that's a great question. You mentioned the term next generation 911. One thing that we have to keep in mind right now is throughout Wisconsin, although your cell phone is a very powerful tool and knows where you are, and Uber can find you, and Domino's can deliver a pizza right to your house. When you pick up your phone and dial 911, even your cell phone, your call is being delivered to 911 centers on 1960s copper wire.
Mm.
And so we don't get a lot of the rich data that Uber and other commercial providers are getting through the cell network. So you pick up your phone, you dial 911. If it's on your home phone, it goes through your local exchange carrier to a central office. If it is obviously on your wireless phone, it hits the nearest tower. Then it's directed based on the tower location largely. And then it's gone to the central office. Then there's a series of what they call selective routers around the state of Wisconsin. And so it's mainly by zip code and geographic areas that are set up in advance with the 911 centers and the telephone service providers to be delivered, which is why many times if you're on the interstate and you dial 911, you might not get the right county. You might get a different county. So, for instance, in Dane County, if you're coming south on Highway 12 out of Sauk City and you're on the Springfield Hill, you dial 911, Iowa County tends to get calls because that's just where it hits. And it's not an exact science. We're hoping that next generation 911, being an IP network in the sky, or in the cloud rather, we hope will should help routing better.
Yeah, where are call centers at in transforming their systems, upgrading their systems to next gen 911?
So my understanding is that most of our PSAPs in Wisconsin, our public safety answering points, are ready. It's really we're waiting on the state of Wisconsin currently, the Office of Emergency Communications, which is falls under the Department of Military Affairs, is in the process of negotiating a contract for an ESINET or an Emergency Services IP network that once they get that done and that contract completed and the service turned on, most of us should be able to simply plug in and be on an ESINET and have the beginnings. It's more than just the ESINET, but that is the backbone of the next generation 911.
And from what I understand, is this system would allow much more communication and cooperation between different agencies and platforms and kind of bringing them all together?
Yes. One of the big benefits, and it's different for an agency like ours where we're so big, us, Milwaukee, Waukesha. What it allows largely for, especially with smaller agencies that have, you know, one or two or three dispatchers, it allows calls to be rerouted and overflowed. And if an agency, due to some internal disaster, can't answer calls, to easily be rerouted. Now, we would have that capability, but the truth of the matter is there's no one place that could answer all our calls.
Yeah, yeah. So kind of it gives you a little bit more of a triage effect.
It could potentially allow calls to be routed differently.
Uh-huh, yeah. If you're just joining us, we're breaking down how 911 call centers work with Paul Logan. He works in the Department of Public Safety Communications with Dane County 911. Are you a 911 operator? How long have you been doing this work? What is it like inside your call center? How have you been doing with the stress of the pandemic? How do you remain calm in an emergency or when it's very busy? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Paul Logan here on the Ideas Network. The role of the 911 dispatcher has evolved. It involves life-saving measures and knowledge. We're talking about the work inside call centers and the profession of 911 communicators here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to NENA, the National Emergency Number Association, an estimated 240 million calls are made to 911 each year. In many areas, 80% or more are from wireless devices. What questions do you have about how the system works? What do you need to understand? Do you know where your community is at with upgrading to next-gen 911? Join in 800-642-1234. Paul Logan is training and standards manager for Dane County 911. He stays with us. Judy is joining us from Fond du Lac. Hi, Judy. What would you like to share?
Well, I remember I was hiding from my abuser, and I called 911 to get help, and I used the pizza line that I was trying to order a pizza. And thank God the dispatcher caught on and sent help.
Oh, my goodness. Judy, thank you. How are you today? How was that call?
Right now I moved, and I'm in an undisclosed location for safety reasons. So it was terrifying.
Paul, what do you do in those situations?
Well, first of all, I just like to, there's no standard line or code. There's nothing like that. I know it's urban legend and urban myths, and we see it on social media now and then, but there's no such thing. We don't train anybody for that. What we train our folks for is to listen for things that are unusual. We answer phones in the same way each time. We ask the same questions. Tell me the address of the emergency. Tell me your phone number. What's your name? Tell me exactly what happened. And if at one of those points somebody said something that is like so bizarre or unusual, that is going to get the call taker, the dispatcher, to probably change their line of questioning and start asking some yes or no questions. Are you free to talk to me? Is there somebody else there? Are you in danger? So that, I just want to get it clear that there's no sort of nationwide code about ordering a pizza, and I hear it all the time, but it's just not the case.
So when your communicator is going through those questions, and they're very specific questions, and I'm sure you have a lot of different flows of questions, how do you teach that and what they should be listening for?
Sure, that's a great question. Active listening is the term that is widely used in our industry, and it's really just more about words. It's listening for background noises when you're on the phone. It's amazing. I mean, in my career, I've heard gunshots and people, car crashes and doors being slammed and walls being punched, all of those different things that can happen. We teach them to listen for tone of voice. We're obviously with communications, being on the radio, being on the telephone, we don't have the luxury of body language and eye contact. So we really have to, we start off at a disadvantage with only words and tone of voice to do the majority of our communicating. So we train to listen for tone of voice and changes in tone of voice. But active listening is a big part of how we train people.
Yeah. I would imagine a skill that becomes better over time.
It absolutely is. You talked about 6 months. I would argue that a communicator or a telecommunicator is not, it's like anything else. I would say that being a telecommunicator, especially call taking, becomes more art than science, and it definitely develops and continues to get better over time with more experience and more reps and more different kinds of calls and more quality assurance, because we have a very robust quality assurance program where we review calls and provide feedback. And with all of that, then yes, you can get better over time.
Operators, the communicators, also delivering some life-saving instructions over the phone.
Absolutely. We started in 2000 with a system called the medical priority dispatch system, and it had started out. We continued with it through. We are a nationally or internationally accredited center of excellence for our use of that protocol. We train, every communicator gets 3 days of training and then lots of days of practice. It's trained by at the very least, a paramedic. For many years, we had a ER doctor that trained our folks. Currently, we do have an ER doctor who's our medical director, who oversees that program. And we, every year, our folks are credited with saving, you know, 20 lives, providing CPR instructions and helping to, you know, save the life of 20 plus or minus people every year. And that's just the folks that actually, you know, walk out of the hospital.
Mm. You know, there is legislation proposed in Congress to reclassify 911 operators as a protective service classification, which would group them with, you know, police and fire. How do you feel about that?
It's good. I mean, quite honestly, though, other than sort of symbolic, it doesn't really change much. They still don't have protected retirement. Communicators still have to work. You know, police officers and firefighters can retire at 50. Communicators, dispatchers, you know, have to work until they can retire. That might be 60 or 62. So it's a good, I think, from a morale and professionalism standpoint, I think it's good. It's a positive step. It means that somebody's paying attention. But we still have our folks that, you know, have to endure a lot. I mean, by the time the police and firefighters and EMS get to a scene of the call, oftentimes, not always, the worst of it is over. But the dispatcher, I mean, we hear everything. Mm-hmm. We hear the mother crying as she's, you know, pulling her baby out of the bathtub. And it's mm-hmm. a horrible thing to say. But many of my coworkers across the country listen to that day in and day out. You know,
how do they deal with that trauma? Where does that go?
It's hard. We are, again, blessed. We have internally here, the county has given us resources. We have a great employee assistance program. We have contract with a company out of Milwaukee that specializes. It's the same company that, like, the police department and the sheriff's department use. They provide critical incident stress debriefing. They provide critical incident defusings. They have mental health professionals on staff. We also have a peer support team right here. We have communicators and supervisors that are trained in peer support and doing these defusings and recognizing when someone needs to be referred to a mental health professional. We have a chaplain, access to a chaplain through our peer support team. But it's tough. We have folks, you know, we're there. We're ear witnesses to so many things. Mm. And sometimes people have to leave the profession because it just gets to be too much. PTSD, there's another thing about, you know, reclassifying dispatchers. The state earlier this year had legislation passed about a PTSD treatment and recognition for police and fire. Dispatchers were not included in that legislation.
I'm going to just reintroduce you here for a moment. Paul Logan is training and standards manager for Dane County 911. Ken in Dodgeville has a question. Ken, hi.
Hi, just wanted to give a shout out to Paul and the fantastic work that all the communicators do and what he does for Dane County. And really, not necessarily a question, but just a point to reiterate the importance of the work that communicators do. Most people don't know that the vast majority of fire, EMS, and law enforcement calls begin and end with what we say in the chair with that dispatcher. And the fact that you can get you know, the services that you need directly to your door in the time of need depends on that person sitting in the chair and the amount of work that goes into it. So the work that they do is just phenomenal. And because we don't drive the big fancy trucks and we're not seen on the street, sometimes they're forgotten. So shows like this and opportunities are fantastic. And thank Paul for his time.
Yeah, and Ken, thank you. You work in communications. How long have you been doing this?
So I previously worked in communication. Now I'm in admission, so I do have some ties with training related to dispatch. And it's tough. Definitely a profession or a specific individual.
Ken, thank you for calling in. Paul, what is the next step for this profession? Where do you see it headed?
You know, I don't know. That's a great question, and I think about that often, especially as I sort of come to the end of my my run. I've been in the business more than 30 years, but it's amazing. I mean, in the mid 90s, I started working for Dane County in 1993 after being on the East Coast doing the business for about 4 years, and you know, pre cell phones. You know, there was a crash on the interstate, or there was a crash on the Beltline, and someone had to get off the highway and find a payphone or somebody with a CB radio. So we might get one call about a crash, and then cell phones come, and now, you know, we can get 20 or 30 calls about a major crash or incident. But now I'm really kind of worried, especially as next generation 911 comes and the potential for callers to send text messages and photographs. We can already send text messages, but photographs.
Yeah, and we'll check in with you on that. Thank you for joining us. Paul Logan is training and standards manager for Dane County 911. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Today, WPR's Carl Christensen brings us a story about Wisconsin comedian Charlie Hill.
My name is Charlie Hill, Sagoli. I'm Oneida. I'm from Wisconsin. It's part of the Iroquois Nation. My people are from Wisconsin. We used to be from New York. We had a little real estate problem.
Charlie Hill grew up watching his favorite comics get laughs on late-night TV. WPR's Beta sat down with comedy historian Cliff Nesteroff, who talked about Charlie Hill's path to becoming an unsung hero of comedy and a symbol of hope for many indigenous peoples.
When Charlie Hill was a kid growing up in Oneida, he was obsessed with television. He would sort of sneak out of his bedroom at night and peek through the door, and he would see his mom watching The Tonight Show with Jack Parr. And one night he saw a comedian named Dick Gregory. He talked about the civil rights movement in his stand-up act. He was really the first comedian to do that. And eventually he would fuse comedy and activism. That was very inspiring to Charlie Hill.
After majoring in speech and comedy at UW-Madison, Charlie Hill headed to Los Angeles in 1972 and started hanging out at the Comedy Store. There, he was a contemporary of many soon-to-be stars, including Robin Williams and David Letterman. One night, Richard Pryor saw Hill perform, and he loved his act so much that he invited him to appear on his TV show, making Hill the first Native American comedian to ever perform comedy on television.
Columbus discovered America. They taught me that when I was a kid. Columbus discovered Indians, you know. That was my education. You see, like, black people, Indians were driven to all-white schools, you see. Except the black people got the buses. The Indians were just driven.
That night, 15 million people saw Hill's act, and his career took off from there, touring the country and eventually landing a spot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Nesteroff describes Charlie Hill's performance that night.
Charlie Hill had this triumphant set on The Tonight Show in 1978 because it was fresh and new to see a Native comedian coming at things from an indigenous angle. You know, it was embraced by this white audience because it was sort of a novelty. The irony is that today that would still be considered a novelty because there has never been another Native American comedian since then to appear on The Tonight Show.
The white men wrote the history books. Out of hell with you, Injun. We got the typewriters. First 20 minutes they were here, they were building houses, and we asked, excuse us, fellas, you gonna stay overnight, huh? Don't you just hate it when you have company over for dinner and they never leave?
Charlie Hill enjoyed a long and successful career in comedy and acting until his passing in 2013. Nesteroff talks about Hill's legacy in comedy, as well as his continued inspiration within indigenous communities.
There's well over 100 indigenous comic performers today, stand-ups, even in the industry, comedy writers and comedy producers. Essentially, all of them will say, yeah, Charlie Hill's the guy. I saw Charlie Hill on A&E's Evening at the Improv, or I saw him on the Arsenio Hall Show, and that was the moment that I decided I wanted to do comedy. He was so important to every indigenous performer, and more than that, he was just important to all indigenous communities in North America as this incredible representative who never sold himself out, who never engaged in stereotypes, was true to himself, was proud of himself, and was an inspiration to thousands and thousands and thousands of indigenous peoples.
I usually have problems doing my act, you know, because I know a lot of you white people never seen an Indian do stand-up comedy before, you know. Like, for so long, you probably thought that Indians never had a sense of humor, you know. We never thought you were too funny either.
Cliff Nesteroff is the author of We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, The Unheralded Story of Native Americans and Comedy. You can learn more about Charlie Hill in the full version of the Beta interview at wpr.org/beta. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Now, the White House announced a trove of incentives this week to step up the pace of COVID vaccinations in our country, like free childcare for parents and caregivers looking to get vaccinated, free tickets to Major League Baseball fans who get vaccinated at a game this month. And then there are states rolling out cash lotteries and sweepstakes. What carrot would it take for you or a loved one to get vaccinated? What ethical concerns or considerations do you have regarding vaccine lotteries? 800-642-1234. Emily Largent is an assistant professor of medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Emily, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's so nice to be here. Thank you.
What do you make of all these incentives just raining down now, from government to corporations?
Yeah, I feel like it started with a donut. Perhaps people have seen news about the Krispy Kreme donuts, yeah. And it seems like the prizes have gotten bigger.
That'll be the start of your research paper. It started with a donut.
Indeed. Yeah, the donut or the stick, I think, is a title I've been playing around with.
What are you seeing out there? And just why is it getting so much traction with all these incentives?
Yeah, so, in the early days when vaccines were first available, we really had a situation where demand for vaccines far outstripped supply. So we had phased distribution plans, and we were trying to think about how we could hand them out in fair and equitable ways. But then we hit a tipping point where vaccine availability opened to everybody, and we have now this unfortunate situation where we have a lot more doses than we have demand. And so the incentives are just a natural part of the process of trying to encourage more people to get vaccinated and keep pushing up the population vaccine numbers so that we can keep with this return to normalcy that we're aiming for.
How persuasive or effective are these strategies, incentive strategies? Can they make people who are opposed to getting the vaccine decide to get it?
So I think that we have to think about all the reasons why people aren't being vaccinated right now. So vaccine incentives, I do think, will work for certain groups. So, for example, there are some individuals who, being vaccinated just hasn't been a priority for them. Maybe they're young, they're healthy, they don't feel like COVID's a particular burden. Maybe they haven't fully internalized the messaging that being vaccinated isn't just good for you, but good for your friends, your family, your community. And so offering an incentive can give them a tangible reason to go and be vaccinated today, now, right? Whether that's a beer or a baseball ticket or $100 or a chance at $1 million. And I think that's a great group for incentives. But there are a lot of reasons, in addition to that kind of just apathy, why people aren't being vaccinated. So you mentioned people who are just against it. And I don't think that somebody who has, say, a philosophical or political objection to vaccination will be persuaded by the offer of an incentive. Similarly, incentives probably won't work for people who are just experiencing practical barriers. So if you need that childcare, or if you still are misinformed and think that you have to pay out of pocket for the vaccine, incentives aren't going to get to those reasons either.
So is it ethical to have these lotteries, $5 million, and up for grabs, millions of dollars states putting out there to get people vaccinated, to get them roll up their sleeve?
So certainly, when we think about challenges or ethical challenges to offering people money, we often want to ask about the activity we're trying to convince them to do by dangling that carrot or donut or $1 million in front of them. And in this case, it's, COVID-19 vaccination. And while these haven't been formally FDA approved yet, we have fabulous evidence from millions of people that these are safe and effective vaccines. And so it wouldn't be wrong to get vaccinated for free. And certainly if you want to do it for $1 million, we're not worried that we're trying to persuade somebody to do something that's wrong, right? So in that sense, we're not worried about it, offering the money to them. Further, we can mandate vaccination by law. Employers can mandate vaccination. The government can mandate it. And so certainly if we can require somebody to get it, offering them money to try to get them to voluntarily agree to do it is not problematic.
There's also some fascinating research around regret lotteries. Like, everyone's name is in the pot. If your name's drawn, they call you. You haven't been vaccinated. Too bad. Are you familiar with regret lotteries, and what impact do they have?
Yeah, my behavioral economist colleagues are very interested in this. And, you know, the hope is that you create a fear of missing out, or FOMO. It works to get my daughter to do things, and hopefully it works to get adults to do things as well. So there is good reason to think that you would really hate to be called and find out that you just missed a chance to get $1 million or a full ride scholarship to college. And so that creating that regret can be a powerful way to get more people vaccinated.
What about smaller sums of money, or, you know, putting a lottery together with smaller payouts, more people getting a chance? Does that up it at all?
Well, it does depend, I think, a little bit on the psychology. So some people are risk takers, or they really, you know, we think about people who play the lottery generally, they have a certain tolerance of risk, and perhaps it's fun to have, even if it's a low chance, you know, a small probability, but a very high payout possibility. Other people like a sure thing. And so maybe for them, knowing it's $100 in pocket once they get the vaccine is going to be better. And, you know, there's past research that's been done on use of incentives to promote health behaviors, certainly never in contexts like this. But we see that small payouts and lotteries can be effective.
We're talking about vaccine lotteries, other incentives to entice people to get the COVID vaccine, with University of Pennsylvania medical ethicist Emily Largent. Do you think lotteries are a good tool in the fight to increase vaccination? Do you think the money set aside for lotteries should be used elsewhere? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Emily Largent on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about vaccine incentives, like chances to win free groceries, plane tickets for a year, or a $5 million grand prize in the case of New Mexico. Should big cash awards, these state lottery programs, be used as an incentive to get more people vaccinated? What happens in the next urgent crisis? It's 800-642-1234. Emily Largent of the University of Pennsylvania focuses on medical ethics and health policy, and she's with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Emily, if your state or your company is in the process of designing an incentive for its people, what would you tell them? What's your best guidance?
Well, I think that we need to think about a broad toolkit. So we need to be aware of the limitations of incentive programs. And I mentioned some of those, right? They're not going to get to everybody's reasons for not being vaccinated. And so we need to think about how to reach the spectrum of people. So some of that will be providing transportation to clinics. It will be taking vaccines to homebound seniors and people with disabilities. It's making sure that people have time off, paid time off, so that they can go get the vaccine and they can recover from the vaccine if they experience any side effects. We're seeing good evidence that that's a real barrier to vaccine uptake right now. There also needs to be targeted messaging to reach people and see why they've been hesitant so far. And I'd also suggest making sure that vaccines are getting into the hands of local physicians, because oftentimes you might have some suspicions or distrust of the broader population of, you know, scientists say at a national level, but you have a lot of trust and faith in your personal physician. So being able to talk to them about whether the vaccine is right for you and roll up your sleeve right there in the office can be really powerful. So just don't get distracted by the fun stuff, and make sure that we're also doing a lot of the other hard public health work that needs to happen.
Some of the things you've said there are echoing what the White House really rolled out this week in terms of trying to reach that 70% at least one dose threshold. When you look at what what is happening at the out of the White House, what do you see there?
Well, I've been really heartened by the Biden administration's approach to all of this. I think that they're right to set an ambitious goal, 70%. And or higher, ideally. I think that they're doing a nice job identifying the range of needs that people have. And I also have been really happy to see that they've made health equity issues and addressing disparities a core part of their approach.
Do you have some examples of this toolbox working here, where giving people a monetary incentive actually changed their health behaviors?
So there have been some studies done to see if, for example, offering incentives can help improve exercise program adherence for people. There's, you know, in this gamification, people talk about it sometimes disparagingly. I don't think we need to be disparaging, but it can. It can help people feel more likely to exercise, more likely to stop smoking. These incentive programs can be powerful to get people to take steps to improve their own health.
We're talking with Emily Largent, who is an assistant professor of medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania, as we discuss the ethics of COVID vaccination incentives and want to hear from you, your take. Do you know someone who's still unvaccinated? Do you think a lottery or a cash incentive would convince them to take the vaccine? What are your thoughts on states offering lottery prizes for people who take the vaccine? 800-642-1234. Emily, as we see so many different incentives out there, what happens in the next crisis is what I'm wondering. You know, what happens if we actually need people in the next pandemic to do something?
Sure. So we're already talking, for instance, about the need for potential booster shots to make sure that people are protected against COVID. And so I do worry that by offering a spoonful of sugar right now, we will get people used to the idea that doing a positive thing for themselves and for public health will come with an incentive. So that could make future vaccine rollout or booster shot rollout less efficient, right? It might be slower if people are dragging their feet to see what's going to be offered, and more expensive, just as we, you know, have to start thinking about budgeting for incentives. But obviously there are trade-offs. There's a huge push right now, given that we still have a lot of people in the population who haven't received a first shot. And so, you know, policymakers have to weigh whether or not the risk is worth the benefit. And clearly a lot of people have decided it's better to focus on the here and now and see what happens going forward.
When I see these corporations getting into it and their names out there with, you know, free airline tickets and cruise ship offerings and, you know, I mean, just the gamut, you know, percentage off merchandise, is, you know, what is the marketing impact of on all this?
Yeah, I'm a bit of two minds about this. I think on the one hand, I really want to applaud these companies for exercising corporate social responsibility and promoting, you know, what I'll just repeat again, is such a great thing for you and for your community if you're vaccinated. That said, it's also very canny marketing, because especially when you think about the Krispy Kremes who came out first, and some of these things that are being offered now, they get us talking about companies and products that maybe we haven't thought about in a while. And once they get picked up by the media, and I'm here talking with you about donuts, yes. Not something I maybe think about a lot in my day-to-day life, or more than I care to admit, maybe. But, you know, that multiplier effect is great. So whatever $1 it costs to buy a Krispy Kreme donut, if we talk about it and people start thinking about it, that will multiply in terms of the outreach and the people who are now thinking about donuts and products. So I think good corporate responsibility, but also great marketing move.
Well, let's bring in Rick now in Antigo. Hi, Rick. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think the incentives are a fine thing, but in Antigo, they're having trouble even scheduling shots. It's like they don't want to open a vial if they don't have 40 people.
So you find access is still an issue, even though there are all these incentives?
Yeah, there's definitely an access issue right now.
Yeah, yeah.
At least last weekend when we were talking about it, I'm not quite sure today.
Yeah. So, Rick, thank you for that. Emily, you know, what are the dynamics there that, you know, in not all areas, is it actually very, very easy to get vaccinated?
Yeah, this has been one of my concerns about the incentive programs is that while I think that they're fine as part of an overall approach, we know that there are still communities, whether those are rural communities or whether they're, you know, communities that have experienced other kinds of structural disadvantage, often, unfortunately, along lines of race and class, you know, they are still having trouble getting vaccines there. And so we don't want to move straight to trying to incentivize people when there are still these structural barriers to being vaccinated. So you have to think about getting vaccines to where people are. Strategies that have been effective there include mobile vaccine clinics. So you can go maybe to a church parking lot and they have a van there. There's been door-to-door vaccinations of people who are homebound in New York State that have been effective. So we really do have to continue thinking about just how to get them to people who want them and have found their path blocked.
Lisa in Brookfield is next. Lisa, hi.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Gee, I heard you say that it's a good thing that we are all getting vaccinated. And I was just wondering, we are the ones that are being vaccinated. But so we're kind of the study. So how would you know it was good? How would we know it's good if we're the ones that are being studied?
Well, they did conduct very large trials before the vaccines were, you know, made broadly available, and there was good evidence there. The FDA promised at the outset that they would do a very rigorous evaluation before they issued the emergency use authorization. And now that we've had millions of people who have been vaccinated, we are able to see both that case rates are going down amongst people who are vaccinated, speaking to how effective they are. And overall, I know there have been some safety issues around Johnson & Johnson with concerns on clots, and you know, people are continuing to monitor this very closely, but it does appear that the number of adverse events and effects have been relatively small. So on balance, everything we see as it's coming in, and we are learning in real time. I agree with that point, Lisa, but it's incredibly reassuring to me, and I think these are really good vaccines.
Lisa, thanks. Emily, you know, what are you watching for as a researcher as all of these lottery programs and incentives, you know, kind of drive forward this pandemic and where we are at this point?
So I think we're at a moment where I feel like we're at a bit of a buffet, right? And we're a smorgasbord approach to vaccination. We have everything on offer from dating apps and, you know, French fries and beers through guaranteed cash in smaller amounts. And then the chances at these very large cash prizes, $1 million, $5 million. And I'm really looking forward to seeing which of these ends up being most effective in increasing vaccine uptake, and also who is taking these vaccines up. I think that we'll learn a lot based on how we're able to motivate people to get vaccinated.
Emily, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Emily Largent is an assistant professor of medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Just ahead, we take a look at universal basic or guaranteed income programs and what's getting traction in cities that have pilot programs. What do you think of UBI, universal basic income? Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.